You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature. The poet Jane Clark has been living in County Wicklow for almost 30 years. In that time, she has grown to know and love the Avonmore River. In this week's Lyric Feature, through poetry and conversation, Jane explores the nature and history of that river. This is Where the River Rises.
So, Richard, will we get down to the river from here, from this crossing?
Yeah, it's a bit of a steep slope, but be careful here.
Yeah, and, I get a bit of a grip in the heather, in the ling.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really lovely. It's just about coming out.
We should also see some frockens, the fruit of the bilberry up here.
Yeah.
Lovely. In the early August, it's at its best.
I'm Jane Clark, and I've been living in Glenmalure, County Wicklow for almost 30 years. And in that time, I've come to know and love the Avonmore River. I swim there, I walk in the hills around it, and I've written poems inspired by the river. In this programme, I'd like to follow the river as it flows southwest from its source close to the Sally Gap right to the sea in Arklow. And along the way, I'm going to meet naturalists and historians who'll be able to tell me more about the ecological and cultural heritage of this wonderful river that gets its name, Avonmore, from the size and the significance of it in this county. I'm here on the banks of the river at the very beginning of the journey of the Avonmore from the high in the mountains in Wicklow. And I'm going to ask Richard Nairn, an ecologist and author, a few questions about this fabulous, long, interesting river. Richard, could you tell us a bit about what stage of the river this is at now?
We're in the very youngest stages of the river. You could say it's childhood. And it's fast flowing. It's just risen in the bog up near the Sally Gap, not too far from where we are here. It trickles out of the bog first. The bog acts like a big sponge and it releases the water slowly, and then it heads fast downhill over waterfalls and rocks and boulders and eventually into the lakes and the valleys.
And would you say the river is in a good state here? Is it quite healthy here? And I mean, I noticed that the water is very brown. And, you know, why is that?
The brown comes from the peat it's bringing with it from the bog. It's naturally brown like that. There's no problem there. It's also very acid in nature, which is, again, natural because peat is itself very acid. And it's also flowing off granite, which is acid. So that would be normal for a mountain lake. And because it's so acid, it doesn't have a huge amount of insect life, for instance. It's too acid for that. It's only in the lower stages that it becomes much more productive and has a much wider range of fish and so on.
So what kind of wildlife would you find near here, in the river here?
Well, in the river itself, you will find, if you lift stones and so on, you will find small insect larvae like caddisflies and that type of thing. But in terms of the bigger wildlife, the river birds are probably the most interesting and obvious. Birds like the dipper, for instance, which is very much associated with fast-flowing rivers like this one.
Yeah, we've seen the dipper here just at this point before. And it's really a remarkable little bird. Like when I grew up in Roscommon, I never even heard of a dipper. It's only since I came to live in Glenmalure that I've heard of them. Why is it not so well known?
Well, first of all, they're quite secretive. And secondly, they look a bit like a plump blackbird. So, you know, if you were just looking from a distance, you'd say, oh, that's a blackbird down having a drink or something. But they are quite different from blackbird in that they have a white, very striking white bib. And their behaviour is very different as well. They will stand on a rock or patch of gravel in the river and they dip into the water, which gives them their name, the dipper. They'll even dive into the water and feed on underwater, on the bottom of the river, on those very insects that I talked about. So they're very much associated with the river, and they don't leave it even in the winter.
You know, they tend to nest under bridges. Do you think there'd be a nest under that bridge there? Is that the kind of place?
That bridge is a modern bridge, so it's made of concrete. So it doesn't have the crevices that an old stone bridge would have. They're not exclusively found under bridges. They're also found under waterfalls, on the rocky crevices beneath the waterfalls.
So there's probably plenty of them nesting further along the river, because there are some mighty waterfalls as you go down the
Avonmore,
aren't there?
Yes, and plenty of bridges as well, old bridges, old stony bridges, which are perfect for them.
The Dipper on Gowadov. You fly upstream while I tramp among snow-dusted rushes along the suckering edge. True as a mandrel, you dive, flickering into the narrow rill. I think I've lost you, but beyond clumps of sedge and withered asphodel, little blacksmith, you bob on an anvil. Droplets fall from your bib. Hammer to chisel, you hurtle notes higher and higher above the river, your treble bell pealing across the heat. Now watch the tussocks there.
Yeah.
We're a little further down the river now, with Kapur and the Tonduffs behind us, where the river rose in the bog there. And there's lots of heather, lots of purple moor grass. It's very boggy underfoot. I can see the sphagnum moss everywhere. And there's some new planting here, Richard.
These are a mixture of rowan and alder trees. And alder does really well in boggy, wet soil, whereas rowan is a kind of mountain. It's known as the mountain ash. And it'll do very well in quite severe conditions of wind and poor soils. These trees have been planted here along the river bank because, first of all, they're down in a dip and they're kind of sheltered from the wind. But secondly, there are some existing old trees along the river, and they act as a seed source, and it's a kind of a natural place to start. And these will gradually produce their own seed and spread out into the surrounding bog. That's what is hoped, in order to try and restore the old woodland that used to occur up here.
And what effect will it have on the river having the trees here?
Well, it's really beneficial for the water in the river, because once these tree roots are established and they bind the soil together, they'll prevent loose peat from washing down into the river. And this is a huge problem in the mountains, where there's a lot of erosion, mainly due to burning over the years. And peat is washing into the rivers and causing all kinds of problems downstream. So any kind of, I suppose, riverside vegetation, particularly tree roots, will help to bind that and intercept it. You know, I'm optimistic that this is going to help both the river and the mountains in the long term.
So it's very dry underfoot here, isn't it? It dried up quite quickly.
But this gets a lot of visitors now, and you can see the effects of erosion from just people walking.
Yes.
You see this everywhere now. It's a pity.
And I think people just don't realise the effect that their footsteps have, how it accumulates when there's so many people walking a path like this.
Yep.
I'm standing at a spectacular viewing point above Loch Tay. Jouse Mountain is behind me, and then the scree slopes of the mountain in front of us, Fancy Mountain. But I can also see very clearly where I was talking to Richard and how the river gets stronger and wider as it comes down from where it rose in the mountains, and it's cascading down towards Loch Tay. At this point, the river's called the Clahog River. Here I am joined by Chris Corlett, who is an archaeologist, a historian, an author, and I've asked him to meet me here because I want to learn more about a settlement on the other side of Loch Tay. What do you know about those ruins over there, and what do they tell us about who lived here?
Today you could probably count on two hands the amount of people that actually live here. But hard to imagine that in 1841 there were 19 houses on just the Clahog side, that's the western side of the valley, with about 149 people living in those houses.
That is so hard to believe. And so, you know, the ridges you can see in the land over there, you know, were they related to the ruins that are over there?
Yeah. So we've got what we call lazy beds. Now, there's nothing lazy about these beds. These are hand dug with spade cultivation, really. So they're backbreaking work. So there's nothing lazy about them. But that's the term that's often used to describe them. I suppose in many parts we talk about them being potato ridges and famine ridges. But it's a bit more complicated than that, because we know that they were also using the same type of technique, spade cultivation, for growing rye and oats, particularly here in the Wicklow Mountains.
Is there evidence of what kind of animals they kept?
So along that green road that joins Loch Tay and Loch Dan, you get a series of little houses. And then when you move up the slope, then you start to see more houses and smaller fields. We're not getting much in the way of outbuildings. So they probably don't have very many animals. They might have a few chickens. I don't know that they have necessarily pigs. If they do have animals, it's one or two cows. Now, they do have good grazing up on the mountainside, if you like, and they have good access to turf for cutting turf and fuel. That's very, very important. But when you look at the farmyards themselves, you can think, okay, they don't seem to have much in the way of animals that they're minding. So they're subsisting on potatoes in many cases. During the famine period, the potato blight itself doesn't seem to have affected this area. Now, this is a tradition, as much as many other parts of the country, for example. But what does happen is that there's definitely pressure on the population. And I think what happens here is that we see a drop from 149 people living here to 95. So that's quite a significant drop in the population levels. That's telling us that there's emigration. People are leaving.
Some of them, at least, would have emigrated and gone to America, to Canada.
I have a funny feeling that some of these families didn't move too far away in some cases, but I'm sure, no doubt, that many have to leave fully.
Yes, yes.
By the early 1850s, there's a big change then, and now we start to see a very dramatic drop in the population, and this time it's not emigration, this time they're being forced out. That's because there's a change in the farming here. Latouche, who owns the place, has been, I think, persuaded by things that he's read and conversations that he's had, that this would make a great sheep ranch. So a lot of those families appear to be forced out, and a couple of new families are brought in, including a family called Dalgleish, and they were sheep herds, and they're brought in from Scotland. And the sheep, also the Cheviot sheep, were also brought in from Scotland. Because it was sheep that they brought in, they didn't start clearing all the houses away or all the fields away. Even the lazy beds were left alone, because it was just going to be grass for the sheep.
These fossilized remains give you great information.
Absolutely,
about
yeah.
what was happening here.
Yeah, it's almost like an archaeological landscape now.
Yes, and gives us invaluable insight into a time in Irish life. This is the perfect spot to read my poem, Lazy Beds, which is inspired by that settlement on the other side of Loch Tay. Lazy Beds. In the shelter of Fancy Mountain, a man and woman from Ballinas Stow rented an acre of rocky soil. Peregrine falcons soared from their nests in the cliffs while they gleaned stones for a two-room hut and a goat pen. They sliced through roots of black bog rush and deer sedge, dug into peat, cutting and turning sod onto sod. They planted potatoes when stone chats clashed pebbles into song. The ridges resisted frost, held flinders of heat. After the harvest of 56, the valley was cleared for flocks of Cheviot sheep. Ewes still graze the heath, rain still ripples down the furrows they built, and once in a while, wind whips water into twisters that dance the width of Loch Tay.
I picked this spot because it's good access.
Okay, yeah.
And we're able to check it regularly, you know. It's only a short distance over. So this way. Just as we're crossing here, you can see, if you look down, just on the fringes, right on the edge of the water, a little sundew plant, a little drosera. So you can actually see in the sunshine the actual droplets on the end. And so they're all the sticky little droplets that the insects get caught in. So it gets its nutrients from flying insects going past.
You would miss it. If you hadn't pointed that out now, I wouldn't have noticed that.
So we've moved to another part of the Avonmore catchment. We're in the middle of a bog. It's a very different landscape to where we were with Chris Corlett looking over Luggalaw. I'm with Hugh MacLinden, who is a conservation officer with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. So Hugh, could you tell me a bit more about where we are now?
We're in the Wicklow Mountains National Park. We're down below Barnacullion Ridge, and we're standing in a very exposed open section of the countryside, which most people probably would never have stepped into, but it's a very special and beautiful blanket bog within the national park.
You're involved in bog restoration work, and we're standing beside these dams. And could you tell me more about that?
So historically, there's been different kinds of damage to these beautiful habitats over the years. So a blanket bog is essentially a store of peat and the vegetation and the biodiversity that lives on top of it. And if they get damaged, they can be eroded. They can literally pour off the hill. So in some cases, we're losing vast amounts of peat off the hill, and it lands up in the rivers and the waterways. And we're trying to prevent that. We're trying to slow it down and stop it and reverse it to the point where we're increasing the biodiversity that once would have been here but is now gone.
How long have you been working here?
Well, we started putting in restoration techniques here just over a year ago now. So the sediment traps that you see behind you here, They're literally a year in progress. So the area looked very different a year ago. As rough as it looks now, it's wet and it's holding water and it's holding sediment, and there's creatures living in those bog pools that didn't exist this time last year.
That is fantastic that you've seen that change already. So like when you say there's creatures here now, when you say it's wetter, would you say a bit more about that?
The first thing you'll start to see, and it's almost instant, is that insects of different, you know, invertebrates of different kind will start to inhabit the pools. And you'll see things like dragonflies coming to hunt over them as well. And there'll be other creatures starting to overwinter in the bog pools, and then they'll emerge in the springtime and fly off. So there could be beetles, there could be different kinds of mayflies and caddisflies. It's early yet. We haven't done much water sampling at this spot, but we will, and we'll be able to tell what is starting to live here, you know. The plant species are what really gets me excited, because I know then that the bog is essentially healing itself. It's able to recover itself, and what we've done is enough to reverse the negative cycle.
And Hugh, these dams, I've never seen ones like that before. I've seen wooden dams.
It's a whole new technique. So this time last year, myself and one of the local sheep farmers, Donnie Anderson, we put our heads together to try and come up with a novel way of A, using sheep fleece, and B, creating sediment traps that work on the bog. So you can see here some of the examples that we've used. There's different shapes and sizes, and we think we have a very effective replacement for the core dam that actually ends up being used in most places. You'll see it. So what happens is that core is imported from India and Sri Lanka and brought through maybe the UK, and it goes a vast distances, and obviously there's miles on the clock in terms of how far it has to travel and the carbon that's wasted just bringing them here. Now, they do a great job, but we'd love to use a local material that effectively at the moment is almost a waste product. So it's almost free of charge, and if we can turn it into something useful, it'll be just a fantastic use of a local product.
And I know sheep farmers will be very pleased to hear about that as well. And obviously, you know, we're in the heart of sheep farming here in County Wicklow as well. So it's wonderful, the connection. And how is what you're doing here related to the health of the rivers?
Well, so many creatures in the rivers depend upon the quality of the water. And if lots of peat and sediment is being washed down in the water, that can cause awful trouble to some creatures. So that if there was pearl mussels in the water, for instance, now probably in the Avonmore, I don't expect to find pearl mussels anymore. They once would have been there, but the water quality is probably too low for that. But bivalves like that would have awful trouble trying to, you know, survive in sediment, water filled in sediment, you know. But there's many other creatures, lots of fish life and insect life. They just struggle.
So in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, how do you think this landscape might be if this work continues?
Wow, there's a question. Well, my hope, my vision for the work that we're doing here is that it'll be much greener. So a lot of the brown, open, bare peat, and you can see there's one just behind you there. So that's, we're kind of trying to work away from that, because literally the wind comes and picks up the peat and it blows it away, or the rains come and they're ever more extreme as they arrive now. And it literally wash it downstream into the waterways. And that's no good for the waterways, and it's no good for the bog and all the creatures that live on the bog. So the last thing we want to do is see the whole bog literally wash away. And we're doing exactly the opposite. And as you can see, there's little plants here all in this bog pool starting to collect and basically root all that peat in place that has been trapped behind that sediment dam, that sediment trap. And that whole bog pool there, which didn't exist last year, I expect it to be much greener in a few years' time, and sphagnum moss to be growing through it, and a whole range of biodiversity to be living within it. That would make me very happy.
It was extremely windy when I was talking to Hugh there in the middle of the bog, so I've moved into a more sheltered spot to read the poem Barnacullion Bog. The ranger strides a sodden path uphill, north of Tonlagee. His straggle of helpers we squelch and slip, stretching for footholds among tussocks of sedge and ribbon grass. Last night's deluge rushes down from the summit. Streams widen and deepen the gullies, push aside frocken and cross-leaved heath. We clamber hummock to hummock, leap across sinkholes, skirt a sheep's skeleton beside plucked feathers of falcon's prey. Golden plover swoop over ling, grouse burst grumbling from their nests. Up ahead, the bog's an ocean of cracked and crumbling peat. But where the soused track winds the ridge, a sheep-proof fence guards fresh growth. Proud as a new father, the ranger shows us wooden dams blocking sediment, hare's tail cottongrass taking hold, sphagnum moss spreading, emerald, burgundy, gold. And now I'm in the Claravale Nature Reserve, which is a large area of ancient woodland between Lara and the meeting of the waters. And I know that it's a very special place, and there's few places like it in Ireland. And Faith Wilson, who's an ecologist, is going to tell me about this woodland. Faith, how does the river interact with the woodland here?
The Vale of Clara woods are not only a really important habitat in their own right, but they're also actually protecting the river. So we don't tend to think of woodlands as having a protective function, but they do. They buffer a river from nutrients coming off maybe more intensively managed land, and they take up those nutrients before they reach the river, and they also regulate flow. So water coming down off hills is slowed moving through a woodland, so it doesn't tend to rush into the river as quickly. So it's a very special place, the Vale of Clara. You probably noticed that there's quite a lot of work going on in the woods, Jane.
I see that very tall steel fencing over there. What's that about?
Well, one of the biggest threats to our native woodlands in Ireland is deer. And the main species that is affecting the woodlands here in Wicklow are either sika deer or fallow deer. And both of those deer aren't native to Ireland. And unfortunately, there's no control apart from culling on deer populations in Ireland. So our woods, even though you walk into them and you think they look beautiful, they're actually dying on their feet because we have very little natural regeneration. Because as soon as a young acorn pops out of the ground as a young oak seedling, it gets nibbled and browsed by a deer. So the trees aren't getting away. It's a big problem. And what's been happening here in the Clara Vale and in other native woodlands is some measures to try and reduce that impact by fencing deer out of areas so the trees can regenerate.
And I'm looking around, I can see some oak, some birch. Are they here a long time, or are some of them new growth?
There isn't very many really ancient trees here in Wicklow. It's not like we're in the UK where you have these, you know, 800-year-old oaks. But the importance of a site like this is that there has been woodland on this site for a long time. So it's the continuity of the habitat. And to have a good functioning woodland, you need a diversity of ages of trees and a diversity of species. So this is on acidic ground. So the typical native woodland here is oak, birch, holly. And that's what you can see around us here. And in the understory, we've got ling heather and bilberry and things like hard fern. And down at the river itself, you have the trees that like their feet in the wet. So you have things like alders and willow. But we also have, unfortunately, a non-native invasive species, so things like rhododendron and cherry laurel. So they compromise a woodland because they dominate. And again, a bit like the deer, which are also non-native, they affect the recovery of the woodland and the wood regenerating. We have this idea that we have to plant trees. Woodlands, if they're functioning well, don't need us to plant trees. The trees plant themselves naturally.
Can I also just ask about that? It looks like a kind of a weed in the river, a kind of a stream, almost like long hair, green hair in the river. What is that?
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful plant. That's a native plant that you find in rivers that are healthy. And it's a species of water crowfoot. It's a member of the buttercup family. And it's actually a habitat of international importance because many rivers on the continent don't have that vegetation anymore. So it's a lovely, lovely species. It provides lots of cover for fish. The flowers, when they form, sit on the surface of the river and you just see this beautiful little white flowers with yellow centres. So a very interesting plant and great to see here.
That's another thing I didn't realise. I've seen those flowers, but I didn't know what I was looking at. And then that reminds me, sometimes I've seen the whirring of a kingfisher along the river. I mean, again, does that tell us that the river is quite healthy here? And is the kingfisher, does it need to have the woods around it? Are they all interdependent as well?
Yeah, well, the kingfisher obviously needs good water quality. It's hunting on small fish. And it also needs a place to perch from, to sit very quietly, silently, sitting, watching, waiting, and then to dive down into the river, catch that fish and bring it back up. And it's something that we don't think about when we enjoy wild places, and we kind of think they're just all there for us as people. Like, this is a nature reserve, and the primary objective here should be about wildlife, not people. And so if we have sort of pathways along every single river, and people walking and dogs and disturbance, how is the kingfisher going to sit and hunt? How is the otter going to move up and down the river? We have to think about where we put paths and where we have people going and make sure we create and preserve wild places for wildlife, not for people.
I hadn't thought about it in that way before, because I suppose I've always thought that we want to encourage people to get close to the river. And yet, of course, we will have a deteriorating effect on the wildlife. So I suppose it's something about getting that balance of helping people get to know the river and yet not letting us dominate all the spaces around that are wild. So that's a really interesting perspective about it. When the tree falls into the river, it slows the current. Water pools in the hollows it makes. Pike and trout find a new place to hide. Beetles, mayfly and mites feed on leaf litter. The mossy trunk lies still as a bridge. A kingfisher settles, watches for minnow. Branches reach for the light, noble with new buds. I'm heading now to Avondale Forest Park, home of the Parnell family, and I'm going to meet Jean Costello, who used to be the manager and curator of the Avondale House and Estate. Most people associate Avondale House, of course, with Charles Stuart Parnell, but who I'm interested in asking Jean about is his sister, Anna. Now we're in the magnificent woodland of Avondale with these tall old trees all around us. And behind us is Avondale House. In front of us is the Avonmore River. And so the house is where Anna Parnell would have grown up. What I wanted to ask you, Jean, is she would have been brought up to be a Victorian lady. And somehow she became this revolutionary, this activist. How did that happen?
Well, first of all, she was born in Avondale House, was there for her first 7 years before her father died and the family moved away. And I think really her mother, her American mother, was a big influence on the family and particularly on the girls, because she encouraged them to get involved in politics, to listen to what was being said, and she exposed them to politics really all over the world, because she took them to America, she took them to Europe, to the UK. And also I would think that Charles Stuart Parnell had some influence, because I'm sure they discussed around the table the politics of the day.
That's so fascinating, how much all her family influenced her. Yes. And allowed her to have a kind of a freedom that wouldn't be usual for women of that time. Because, like, to go and give speeches all over the west of Ireland, in England, in America, standing up on the back of carts in these very tight dresses that they wore at the time, long dresses. So she was a very brave woman.
She would have been a woman before her time. Not just her, of course, her sister Fanny was also involved with her, and they took off across to America and to the UK and started up various associations, gathering funding and distributing it before they became involved in the Land League in Ireland.
So Michael Davitt and Parnell himself asked her and the others to set up the Ladies' Land League when they were put in prison.
The men were going to be arrested, so they needed to keep their land league going. And the idea was a ladies' land league would be a good idea, and Anna could head it up and keep this going. But I think the men thought that they would be just keeping the seat hot. They didn't expect them to do anything. So they only gave them an office. They didn't give them anything else. And before they knew it, the women had 500 branches sprung up around the country, thousands of women involved, leaving the stove behind them and heading out to meetings, collecting the fundraising, distributing it, much to the surprise of the men and the government, who weren't too happy at the time. And the government, in fact, would have liked to have shut them down, but they were afraid of the women. That's what I heard now at the time. They were afraid what repercussions they would have. So they let them on, because it was really an illegal association at that time.
And It's amazing, isn't it, that we heard so little of this?
Obviously, it wasn't on school curriculums. It was only Charles Stuart Parnell that was on school curriculums, and they were forgotten, written out of history, maybe.
It is good that, you know, the people are learning about her now. She did, when she fell out with her brother, and when Fanny died, the tragedy of her sister's death, everything took a very sad turn in her life then.
It did. The end of her life was very sad. She died in 1911 after a drowning accident in Ilfracombe. Nobody knew she was Charles Stuart Parnell's sister till they went to the small home, the room she rented, and very meagre possessions. And people were amazed to discover who she was, that she had lived in their area for so many years.
She really did want to influence women, didn't she? And I suppose I'm wondering about her legacy, and what would you see as her legacy now?
Oh, I think her legacy was that she would or had influenced women of coming into the future. It's a pity it has taken so long, and I hope that some people have been influenced by her.
Well, I'm glad to say that I'm one of the women who has been influenced by Anna Parnell. And I've written a sequence of poems, but this one was inspired by learning that her first public speech for the Irish National Ladies Land League was in Claremorris, County Mayo, in 1881. Anna in Mayo. Slight as a sapling, she tramps rough byroads, clambers ditches and sprints across bogs to evictions from hovels that families call home. When police block a bridge, she tucks up her ruffled dress and crosses the Erif on the shoulders of a friend. Women leave kitchens in Claremorris, Ballyhaunus, Belmullet, Ballinrobe, to hear her speak of freedom. She bids them stand together, learn to depend upon yourselves, and never let each other be threatened or oppressed. So now I've arrived to the meeting of the waters a few miles downriver from Avondale House. And here's where the Avonbeg River meets the Avonmore. The Avonbeg has come through the Glenmalure Valley where I live, and the two rivers converge here, and then the Avonmore becomes the Avoca River. And Faith, who I met earlier in Clara Vale, is down on the banks of the river, and I'm going to talk to her about the health of the Avoca River from here on down to the sea. Faith, we're sitting in a really beautiful place on the side of the river. But when I think of the Avoca River, what I think of is pollution, because that's what its reputation is. But I really wanted to ask you about that.
Downstream of here, below the White Bridge, the water quality has been very poor for very many years. And that's essentially due to the acid mine drainage from the mining in the Avoca mines. It's also that we had essentially sewage discharging from Avoca Village and also from Arklow Town directly into the river. So the wastewater treatment plant in Arklow is under construction at the moment, and the Avoca wastewater treatment plant is also going to go into construction. So those two elements alone will make an enormous difference to water quality. So the river went from being kind of polluted to moderately polluted. So the scientific term is Q2. So it went from Q2, which was kind of fairly polluted, to Q3, which is moderately polluted. So it's actually, the water quality in the river has improved. Like, when I moved into this valley, my memory of the beautiful Vale of Avoca was as a child coming through it, and the mines were active. It was like going through a moonscape. There was just dust and machinery and this active mine. And then you drive further down the valley, you get to beyond Wooden Bridge, and the net nitrate factory, Irish fertiliser plant, was operational. And all the trees in the valley were dying back their tips because of the emissions from the fertilizer factory. And now, some 40 years later, the mines have closed, the fertilizer factory has closed. The vegetation has recovered, and a lot of areas of what was bare, scorched-looking earth in and around the mines is slowly regenerating with heathers and birch and Scots pine and lichens and mosses. So it gives me amazing hope for the resilience of nature.
That's wonderful to hear that, because even where we're sitting here, the trees look so healthy. There's a lot of bird life. The river looks very healthy. I know that you're involved with an organisation called the East Wicklow Rivers Trust. What role has it had to play in this change in the river?
Yeah, well, we set up the East Wicklow Rivers Trust just to develop a voice for rivers and catchments as a kind of an entity in their own right, because there's different bodies have different responsibilities, like Inland Fisheries Ireland are responsible for the fish, National Parks and Wildlife Service are responsible for, you know, the protected areas and the wider landscape. But there was nobody to kind of bring people and the river and all the agencies together. So that's why we set up the trust, and we got some funding through LEADER to actually pull together all the information on the Avoca Avonmore catchment, because it's the most incredible catchment. And all anybody ever heard was, oh, the Avoca, the most polluted river in Ireland. And we set out to change that narrative. And there's a lot of research has been done in this catchment, but it's all in obscure scientific reports and technical papers that Joe Public doesn't read. So what we did with our vision for the Avoca Avonmore catchment report, which you can get on our website, was to pull all that information together and share the wonders of this whole system, everything from, you know, the mountain blanket bogs to the lakes around Loch Tay and Loch Dan and the lakes in Glendalough, the Corrie Lakes up in the mountains, the amazing woodlands that we met at earlier today, and all the species that it supports, from gooseanders to salmon to dippers to rare mosses. It's an amazing place.
It's so exciting to hear about this work. And one of the things I was wondering, Faith, is have you seen any change in the general public's relationship with the river?
I think people discovered a reconnection with the wild during COVID. I think when people couldn't travel, they had to find out what was on their doorstep. And actually, nearly everybody in Ireland is within a short distance of a river. So to even find your local little stream and to see a few little pinkeens in it, or, you know, to sit at the river and watch a grey heron fishing, it kind of grounded people, and it gave people solace in a time that was quite frightening. And that's what the natural world does for us. We just have to connect in. So I think there's a bit of a sea change, and I think we need hope, and we need to have an idea that there is resilience and that there can be recovery, and a lot of it is about undoing some of the things that we've done to our habitats and to the natural world. And every single person can do something for their local river. Just look at your own house, look at the connections at the back of the house, make sure that your foul water from your dishwasher isn't going into the surface water system, make sure it's going into the foul water system. Simple things like that. And trying to keep wild places wild, that's very important too.
As I've followed the Avonmore River, I've been struck by how it has influenced every aspect of its hinterland over thousands of years and shaped the landscape, the flora and fauna, and of course the people. It seems to me that up until recently, we've assumed that the river was there for our use and also that it was indestructible. But now we're realizing that we depend on it and that our activities have been destructive through industry, intensive farming, urban waste. But in the midst of all this bad news, all the people I've met, the historians and the ecologists, have encouraged me to think about how our relationship with the river is changing. I think there's a cultural change where we're realizing that we're dependent on the river and that we need to take care of it. As well as walking the banks of the Avonmore and writing about it, I've also swum in this river many times over the last 30 years. And in this, my final poem, I want to capture the exhilaration of stepping in. Stepping in. Rain stipples the river as you huddle for shelter, balancing on one foot to undress, then clamber over the fence for the down the bank scramble through cattails and hazel. Bone-cold awakening of skin. You ask yourself why, though your body remembers in every cell. Lemon-mossed pebbles, damselflies glancing on brooklime and alder, scent of the bog from above Glendassen, and the current that takes you, alert, electric, alive.
Where the River Rises was presented by Jane Clark, produced by Claire Cunningham, and sound supervision was by Tin Pot Productions. The contributors were Richard Nairn, Chris Corlett, Hugh MacLinden, Faith Wilson, and Jean Costello. Jane Clark's poetry is published by Blood Axe Books, and Richard Nairn's latest book, Future Wild, Nature Restoration in Ireland, is published by New Island Books. Where the River Rises was a Rockfinch production for RTÉ Lyric FM, funded by Cumasúin na mBan with the television licence fee. And that programme is available to podcast on all the usual podcast platforms and on the RTÉ radio player. You can contact the programme by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie. The series producer is Owen O'Kelly and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.